the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World, 5 p.m. here on November 28th in Las Vegas, Nevada. That was the wonderful voice of Sarita singing Sunny to Me. And of course, you recognize the speaking voice of one of the greatest entertainers of all time, and that's Francis Albert Sinatra. The night he took over The Tonight Show and had me on as his very first guest, for which I will forever be indebted. As I speak to you right now, you're all well aware that Jill Stein of the Green Party has gotten considerable funding to go into recounting the vote in Wisconsin to find out if Hillary won or if Trump won. But it doesn't matter which one of them won, because we all lost. Now, I don't really want to say a whole lot about Donald Trump, except it is true that since he's become president-elect, he has improved the stock market. It is now 19,000. He's improved the economy, 3 million new jobs, all protesters. So, but I've had a number of people sending me, he has improved Saturday Night Live and given Alec Baldwin a renewed career for the next 4 years doing his fabulous impression of Donald Trump, for which Donald Trump is asking equal time, but he will never get it because there is no more equal time in America, no more fairness doctrine in America. That's all because of an appearance by Jim Garrison on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, when he said the Central Intelligence Agency murdered our president. And of course, the owners of the country no longer wish to hear that. So they got rid of the fairness doctrine, they got rid of equal time, and they made sure that individuals could no longer own television or radio stations. In 1970, there were 1,500 individual owners of television stations. Now only six corporations, thanks to Bill Clinton's signing of the Communications Act in 1996, now six corporations own 5% of American media. But I've had a lot of wonderful fans sending in jokes about Trump, and I think I should pass a couple on to you so you could at least smile while you were suffering the downwards plunge of the American empire. This one is credited to Jimmy Kimmel. And Jimmy said, you know, a lot more women probably were groped by Trump but weren't aware of it, because his hands are so small. and then Seth Meyers said that Trump said when he becomes president, he will be ISIS' greatest nightmare. And then he's added, does that mean Trump's going to run for president of ISIS also? But from my own side, let me tell you, as an expert on immigration law in the United States, Donald Trump did say he was going to form a deportation task force. Well, I got news for Donald. He doesn't have to do that. He just needs somebody to print tickets, because there will be thousands and thousands of Mexicans asking for voluntary departure. And since my guest is one of the best and brightest businessmen I know, I'm going to ask him live in just a few minutes if he would become my partner in making a new baseball cap. Today, Donald Trump, our president-elect, unveiled a new baseball cap, and it says on the front of the cap, "Make America Great Again." I would like my guest to help me make that hat, and underneath it say, "Impeach Trump." Anyway, you have all seen that beer commercial advertising the most interesting man in the world. More proof that TV lies, especially commercials, because the most interesting man in the world is my guest, who drinks only water and coffee. He owns the biggest name in magic, Houdini, and also the biggest heart of anyone I have ever met. Without him, we would not have finished the rough cut of the American media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which we screened this last Monday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to over 200 people at the Texas Theater, where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, to such an unbelievable standing ovation. It lasted so long, I was unable to do the question and answer period that I had promised. I was so moved by their reaction to that film, I just had to thank them, tell them the film was blessed, get in a car, and get back to the airport. I love storytellers, from Charles Dickens to America's O. Henry to France's Guy de Maupassant to Mark Twain to my guest. While finishing the editing of this film, of which he is co-producer, every day we go across the street here in Vegas to Bonefish, where he regales all of us with wonderful, wonderful tales of old Las Vegas. He has known jerks and giants, con artists and killers, hustlers and heroes. Now, you might guess from this brief introduction, he is Italian. Well, that he is, a very successful businessman that he also is, as one of the best FM stations here in town, which he will tell you about shortly. He's the very essence of the perfect American entrepreneur and my friend and my hero, Gino Minari. Gino, welcome so much to the show. I really appreciate your being here.
Pleasure that you asked me, and it's nice to be with a mover and shaker.
Well, it sounds like salt and pepper to me. I'm the salt and you are the pepper. We make a great team, and I'm so, so glad that you are a major part of this film and now a major part of my life. Now, I hate to throw this at you immediately, Gino, because it's news, but it's Italian, and it's a thing called Pizzagate. Have you heard anything about what they call Pizzagate, which is all over the internet now?
This is a new one to me.
Well, you know, it's a new one to me. And after the half hour, when we're joined by your countryman, another Italian-American, Joe Satilli, we'll probably get into it. But evidently, it is getting a million hits around the world. It's supposedly they're revealing a pedophilia ring that Hillary Clinton and Podesta are involved in. It's and Obama, all these leading Democrats, and it's supposed to be out of some pizza parlor in New England. Now, listen, I do not believe that any pedophilia ring would come out of a pizza parlor. That's for openness. But I do believe that these people are so warped, Gino, that they would use the language of the pizza parlor. So I'll just run this past you. We'll let you incubate on this for a while, and then we'll get to your story. According to the internet and the email leaks about this pedophilia ring, pizza is just a girl, and cheese is a little girl, and pasta is a little boy. Ice cream is a male hooker, and walnut is a person of color that they want delivered to the house. And supposedly a bunch of them went to the White House. Okay, I don't want to get bogged down in that. We'll get to that later. So I've got to ask you, how on earth, you are an incredible, incredible magician, and from what I understand, the largest seller in the world of magic tricks. How on earth did you become interested in magic, and why?
Well, that's a big introduction. When do I give you the $5? Well, actually, you know, as a kid, I was kind of fascinated with puzzles and things, but I was 12 years old, and I was very active. I mean, played baseball, swam, did everything you can possibly do as a kid. And first day of summer, I went down to the park with my friends, and I got on the monkey bars, and I'm swinging, you know, from bar to bar and grabbing the next bar and moving. And I was swinging a little bit, lost my grip, I fell backwards onto the ground, and broke my right leg in two spots.
Oh,
and,
my.
So I was laid up for the entire summer from my waist down to my toe with a cast. Couldn't bend my leg. It was miserable. And my dad went and got me a book and a magic trick and to try to cheer me up, I guess. And I got interested in doing that. I couldn't go anywhere else. I couldn't swim, couldn't play baseball, couldn't do anything. So that was the start of it, and always kept interested in it. But when I went to Las Vegas and worked in the gaming casinos, I was kind of afraid to even talk about that I even did anything like that, because they would think that maybe I was stealing money or would use that to steal money. So I never had a chance to really perform. But then one day, you know, I was working at the Dunes Hotel and later on, and some of the dealers would say, hey, you just missed Jimmy Grippo, one of the greatest magicians of all time that worked at Caesar's Palace for 25 years as a magician in residence.
You're kidding. That, on stage or in the lounge?
In their restaurants. He was a magician in residence. And before that, he was at the Desert Inn Hotel for Mo Dalitz. And he worked there for a period of time. And he went from the Desert Inn to Caesar's, and he had asked permission to those guys to do so. Anyway, I'd miss him by just a minute. I'd come into work, and he said, he just left. So one night, I went over to Caesar's Palace and had dinner there, and I met him. And it was the most fun evening I think I had in the history of my time in Vegas. I watched a guy do these tricks that looked like real. I said, how did he do that? Those are nothing I ever saw in any book I ever got on magic, you know. So I thought it was fun, and he was my idol. And that was kind of like the real start of me getting to a point where I could perform. And that's the story.
And when did you finally get the courage to feel that you could get up on stage and actually do an act?
Well, after my mother told me, are you going to show me that trick one more time? No. Do I have to pick another card? I mean, you know, that was the point, right? And so somewhere I wish I had this picture. I have a picture someplace. I don't know where it is. But me in front of this table my mom had, I painted it red. I put my name. I was embarrassed of my Italian name as a kid, John. You know,
I'll
tell you why. No, all the kids I went to school with were names like Smith, Brown, Jones. So now Munari.
I would be embarrassed with those names.
Well. So anyway, I was kind of embarrassed, and then when I would get into class. Hold on a second here. I would get into class. The teacher would mispronounce my names and so forth and so on. So anyway, finally I read this book about Houdini, and he had an I on the end of his name. And I said, well, I've got an I on the end of my name. So,
oh, how wonderful.
It's good enough for Houdini,
is that
good
Lola
enough for me.
In the background?
That's Woofy, yeah. That's my dog, Lola. And she's eating a few people over here. That's enough, Lola.
She follows you everywhere.
1 second, John.
Sure.
Anyway, so that's how I got it. But anyway, I was telling you about this table I had. I painted my name on this table, Minari, like I was some kind of a great magician. And I put every trick that I had in my house on that table. I had a tube, and I had a silk, and I had a magic wand, and I had a candlestick, and I had cards. And then, you know, I did a couple of shows, and like when I was 12 or 13 years old, and it was fun. And that's all I can say, it was fun. But I also like gambling. And gambling and magic kind of went hand in hand. There was a couple of things in some books I read, and I said, hey, that's interesting. So, you know, but what it is really, and I'm not here to talk about my business, and I'm not going to talk about my business, but I'm going to talk about something that's good for youth to get interested in getting better in reading and getting better in understanding and comprehension are tricks and puzzles. There's no question. It makes you think about things. So it's a lot of fun, and they're also very good icebreakers for meeting people. You know,
well, you ended up owning the greatest name in magic, which is Houdini, which you just mentioned. How on earth did that happen?
Houdini and I had a talk one day, and I said, Harry, actually, when I was a kid, I used to make little Houdini tricks, and made a little set one time. I tried to sell the set to somebody, you know, as a kid, you know, made a little trick up and sold it for 10 cents or something like that. Little typed instruction and thing, and then later on I opened my first major store in one of the theme parks of the MGM Grand, and they wouldn't let me use the name like a trade name. They wanted it was in a craft center, so they had a glass shop, they had a candy shop, they had a wood shop, they had a jewelry shop. They wanted a magic shop, so I put magic shop up there. And so I started selling Houdini magic kits I would make up, and it was the best seller of all. So when I relocated to another location, I took the trade name more prominently and then developed the Houdini trademark, Houdini Magic. And that's how it all started.
Well, didn't you inherit some of Houdini's stuff?
Well, I did not really inherit it directly from him. But
his brother?
As a young man, I met his protege, his brother's protege, Sid Radner, who was a guy, and I met him in the early, the late 70s, and he came to one of my, I did a little gambling act I did, and I showed you how to deal seconds, and I showed you how to do all kinds of tricks with cards, and he enjoyed it, and I met him, and we became friends until he died, and he had all of Houdini's brother, who had Houdini's memorabilia. He collected it all. And over the years, I bought some pieces. He gave me some pieces. And then he decided to have an auction. And in the year 2000, and I guess it was, 2004 or 5, we had the Great Houdini Auction. And we sold this entire collection. It was quite interesting. So
I was stunned. I was sitting with you one day in the editing room, and in pops this tall, good-looking guy from New Zealand. He just showed up to buy something from you and paid a small fortune for it. How come? Tell me about him.
Well, we do have prominence in the world, and the collectors know collectors. If you collect a certain item, you know who the other collectors are.
What was it he bought?
He bought an actual Houdini key.
A key to one
of his locks or one of his handcuffs. I believe it was a small handcuff key.
It was so interesting. You said that gambling is akin to magic. You were also a dealer at many places here in town. Tell us about that and how you became a dealer.
Well, when I was 18 years old in Burbank, California, and I decided that there was nothing to do there. So I said, I'm going to go to Las Vegas and maybe go to school or just live and try to get a job and see what happens. So I thought I would enroll in UNLV. It was called Nevada Southern then, by the way, Nevada Southern University. And I went up to Las Vegas, and I had a cousin, a second cousin, who was the original partner with Milton Prell at the Sahara Hotel. They came from Montana together, and I thought maybe if I'd see him, maybe I can get a job, but naturally, he gave me a job all right as a busboy. You had to start from the ground up, and I started off as a busboy in the dealer's room, not the dealer's room at the Sahara, but at the coffee shop, and then one day an opening came up. Hey, they need somebody in the dealer's room, and the busboy, he quit. Do you want the job? And I says, yeah. And I got the job, and I was making 1965. I'm going to give my age away. 65 and 64, I was making like 50, 60 bucks a day. And I didn't have any bad habits. So, so that was that. And then, so all these dealers would come in every 20 minutes, and I'd see him come around the counter from the front of the coffee shop. I knew what each guy drank. I'd have his coffee ready. I had his water ready. Had to have water with his coffee. You know, that was a big no-no. No water, well, no tip.
You were working in Vegas in the days when it was obvious that the mob or the boys or whatever.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. I used to go to the cage to get some change or take some quarters over there. One of the pit bosses would say, "Hey, come over here a second. I hear you're learning how to deal." I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Get on the table." And he put me on the blackjack table in the Sahara Hotel with a busboy jacket on. And it was, you know, it was crazy, you know. And the dealers would tell me how to cut the chips by using coffee saucers. You know, they'd say, pays 3-2. So they'd put two saucers down, and I'd pay them with three. You know, you know, it was hilarious, you know.
Well, we were talking about some hustlers, and I brought up, since I'm into golf, I brought up this story of this Titanic Thompson. And the story that I told you about Titanic Thompson, he at one time bet somebody $10,000 that he could hit a golf ball a mile. And so somebody took the bet. And, of course, the bet was made in August of that year in the Midwest. And he didn't demonstrate it until January the following year on the edge of Lake Michigan. He teed up a ball on the beach, and the guy gave him the $10,000 because Lake Michigan was ice. And then you started telling me stories of other people. Tell that horseshoe story. God, that is funny.
He used to come into the Stardust, and he also was in one of the first World Series of Poker at Binion's. I've got a picture of him, and my friend knew him, but he was a kind of a guy. He would gamble on anything. And one time he went down to Phoenix. He heard that there was a guy that was a good guy that played horseshoes. Okay, and this guy, so he knew this guy was a good horseshoe player, and the guy played for some real serious cash. So he went in the area, and he moved into the area, rented a place, and he set up a horseshoe pit, and he purposely made the horseshoe pit where the stakes were too long. In other words, a foot longer or a foot and a half longer. Not much, just enough. So, you know, he'd practice, and he could ring it. And that means, you know, you'd throw the horseshoe, and you'd ring the little stake out of the ground with a nice ring, a nice sound that came out of it. The guy could almost do it blindfolded. And he could do it left-handed and right-handed. So now he would practice, and he was good. So this guy gets into he finds out about this Titanic, this other player. And Titanic looks like a rank sucker. You know, he looks like a rank amateur. You know, drops cards when he plays cards with you. You know, drops the horseshoes. You know, the whole deal. And naturally, of course, this guy throws the first shoe. And it lands short. He can't understand what's wrong with him. Oh, I got a bad day today, you know. Anyway, beat him out of a ton of money. But the other time, he played the country club out here. And he beat a guy by one stroke, you know. Maybe go around the first nine and be even, then beat him by one stroke, and the guy would fork over the money. It looked like, you know, it was a good game. So finally the guy said, "Let's get even." And he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll may even make it better. I'll play you right-handed. And so, naturally, Titanic was, he was playing him left-handed, and he was a natural right-hander. Beat him out of all of his money.
Oh, my. So. You know, how is it possible, Gino, that somebody who's a young boy could think that he's going to grow up the rest of his life cheating people in very imaginative ways? But was your father a bit of a hustler?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I don't know, though. I got to tell you something. He did lots of things, but he gave me an idea. My father gave me an idea for a movie I made. I made a movie one time, made a home video product movie, and it was called Little Scams on Golf. And I didn't title it. Rich Little did, and that's why it's called that. But the idea was mine, and I wanted to show things that my dad showed me, how they cheated on the golf course. A couple of things. My dad had a driver, a one driver, or I call it a one club, and it was a wooden club, and he had another identical one to it that had the inside of it hollowed out, and he had liquid mercury inside of it. And he could hit the ball about 10 yards farther. He played at Lakeside Country Club in Burbank all the time.
So, oh, my God. I belonged to Lakeside for about a year. Oh, my God.
And then he sold about 20,000 acres of land down by Salton Sea under this little-known act of 1850-something called the Desert Land Entry.
And, oh, my.
Anyway, but he was an honest guy. My dad was an honest guy, the hardworking guy.
And, well, you're an honest man, and you're certainly a hardworking man. There must have been times, though, in those days, even though the hoods were running the clubs, that there must have been some people who sort of successfully were able to count cards at blackjack or do some things to beat the house. Were there any such cases
Yeah. Guys like Joe Bernstein or Junior Guttering used to dress like a woman, and he was one of the early card counters in town. And yes, you can beat the game if you have the right kind of a dealer, you have the right kind of rules, and you have the right kind of game set up. In other words, if the game is a single deck or double deck, and they don't follow the procedures the way they should be done, there's a right and a wrong way to run a casino, okay? You know, people don't even realize this, John, that blackjack's supposed to pay 3-2, right? Most of the hotels pay you 6-5. So you wonder why people don't win, you know? I mean, the old guys around Las Vegas, like, for instance, around the Stardust, a guy that was the founder of Thorpe, was the founder of card counting as we know it. It was around before Thorpe wrote it up. He was a professor in the University of Arizona somewhere. And he wrote a book about it, about blackjack. And I can't think of the name of the book right now, but it's a great book. Professor Thorpe on blackjack is all you need to know. And he showed you how to count. Well, when he was practicing in the Stardust, a friend of mine as a pit boss saw that he was counting the deck down. And he cut into him. He started talking to him and said, you know, what are you doing? And he actually told him, he said, I've got a method. And they let him do it. And if it wasn't for the card counters and the way they let him play, blackjack wouldn't have been a successful game as it is today. People actually think they can beat it, and that's what made it good.
Yes, but now they don't. Almost no club has a single deck anymore.
There's no gamblers anymore. Those guys are all bean counters. They're afraid to give a guy a gamble. I mean, I'm sorry, and there's some guys I really like in the business, but I was hardcore in this gambling business when I was, you know, I couldn't get a job as a magician because nobody would hire me. So I went to work in gaming and I learned the games, and I was so interested in magic, I wanted to learn every move that could be made against me so I could protect that game. And that's how I used my knowledge of magic as an asset to help me watch the game.
When did it become evident to you, Gino, that the hoods really ran the places rather than just rumors about these guys are a bunch of hoods? Did you ever see anything?
First day I went to work.
First day I went to work.
I used to be around these guys since I was a kid, and I went to work at the Sahara, and you know, you heard stories right away about this guy and that guy and this guy and that guy, and finally I went downtown and broke in and learned the games, and you heard stories and you heard guys talk about guys. Remember, gambling around the country was illegal. It was not a legal situation. So there was a lot of cheating going on. They had a run from the police. They only had a short time to operate. We had a dealer at the Sahara. His name was Bunny Stanger. If anybody's out there listening, remember his name very well. One of the nicest guys. And he used to give me pointers about how to deal, you know. He used to tell me when he worked in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that was before Rockefeller gave it to the government, you know, the whole place.
Mm-hmm.
They had a saying in the little casinos they had up there called, when the season's short, so is the deck. Meaning it was cold weather, you took an ace out of the deck, you know, so they'd have 25% chance of getting a blackjack.
Well, yeah, so. You know, the astonishing thing of all of these interesting people you met, you mentioned Mo Dalitz a little while earlier. He's the guy that was forced to sell his casino to Howard Hughes because Howard Hughes wouldn't move. And there's no question that Mo Dalitz was a major mobster and player in this town. But you mentioned this story. Since you're as knowledgeable about the assassination of John Kennedy and about the background of Jim Garrison as anyone I ever met. And you mentioned this dealer or sharpshooter that had a meeting with Mo Dalitz. Tell me about that and how it happened.
Well, you know, what's interesting, I got interested, first of all, John, if I can just go back just a bit. I got interested in the Kennedy thing in about 1967. When growing up in Burbank, my father had a friend. His name was Dick Westbrook. And he had a motel called the Olive Manor Motel, right on Olive Manor, right down from NBC Studios, across the street from the Olive Recreation Center. That's in Burbank. And you would know it if you were in Burbank, and I'm sure you do. Right down from Genio's. That's where the St. Louis Browns from St. Louis used to come out and play winter baseball. Westbrook was an old-time guy. I think he was involved with a guy that was a bank robber who used to have an airplane. And in the late 30s and 40s, they'd fly around and rob banks. And they'd
in an airplane?
Get in the plane, get in the, yeah, they'd have a getaway with the airplane, and then the cops couldn't catch them. You know, and it was a true story. So there was one guy that was, his name was Lee Turner. That was his partner. And I know that Westbrook must have been the beneficiary of some of that money, some way or another. Anyway, he left St. Louis. The Hots chased him out of St. Louis. He had a gaming, he had a vending machine route, and they were moving in there. So he went out to Burbank, where he knew the baseball players were, where betting and sports betting was going to happen. And he was my dad's friend. And then, so his kid was a couple years younger than me, went to the same school with me, and he got in trouble. And I was in Las Vegas, and he called my dad up, and he said, listen, Bobby's going to have to go to away to jail if he doesn't get out of town. The judge gave him an ultimatum. If he lets him go out of town and change his friends and stuff, can he come to your house and stay there? And my dad says, why, sure, we'd be happy to help you. So Westbrook called this black judge in town called Moon Mullins. He was downtown for years and years. His name was Moon Mullins, and Westbrook arranged it, and legally, Bobby was transferred to our house. Of course, he never stayed there, but he was transferred there. And Westbrook says, and don't worry, Judge, I'm going to get these guys income. Westbrook took us to the Frontier Hotel. Here we are. I was about 20 or 19. I don't remember exactly. And Bobby was about 16 or 17. Went to the Frontier Hotel, and Westbrook had all these friends there. And I remember going to dinner with him one night. And here's R.D. Matthews, here's Johnny Stone. Johnny Stone was the biggest bookmaker in Dallas, and the bookmaker in Dallas. And
this Matthews guy, R.D. Matthews.
R.D. Matthews was a friend of his, and he had a patch over his eye. And they were called before the Warren Commissioner of the House Assassination Committee about some different things.
Wow.
I know both names I gave you, and they were all around the Frontier. And then all of a sudden, there's another name pops up, and then another name pops up, like Johnny Roselli. And then Roselli had the gift shop in the Frontier, and a few other guys. Anyways, all of a sudden, I got interested in this subject matter, and I realized, hey, these guys are not too far away. So, you know, so one day, a guy comes to me, and he says, would you help me write my book? And this guy says, I was a partner. Lansky sent me out here, Meyer Lansky, and I had doubts about this, but I said, well, let me look at it. So I started helping him write his book, and he had an outline already, and I started getting into it. But the carrot that got me, the bait that got me to write his book, was the fact he said he was partners with Johnny Roselli, was hired by Robert Mayhew to kill Castro. Okay?
Wow.
Johnny Roselli. And so Johnny Roselli also got Sam Giancana involved in it, and they were going to use the mob to kill Castro. And so anyway, I got interested with all these guys around here, and I started doing some research. And so one day I'm writing this book, and in comes a friend of mine, known for years from the Sahara days, my dad's friend, and he says, what are you writing? I says, I'm writing this book here. And he says, oh, yeah, sometimes I'll tell you a story. And he told me a story how he was in Phoenix City, Alabama, and he was a former Marine. And in any event, he wound up in Las Vegas, came out here, and he was asked about how good he could shoot, but he was never asked to kill the president or nothing like that. And that's a time for another time. That would take 2 hours to tell that story. But all I can tell you was it was enough to wet my whistle to wonder what was going on here.
And, well, Gino, we're going to take a break right now, and then we're going to be joined by Joe Satilli, who can explain a little bit of Pizzagate to us. But then I want you to tell us just a little bit about this fella whose marksmanship was tested by Mo Dalitz, and then he was invited into a meeting. I'd like you to tell us about that meeting and who was there and how you verified it. We're going to be right back with the wonderful Gino Munari and the incomparable, the best newsman in America, Joe Satilli. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
At last.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. Or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you very much for rejoining us. Joining us now, Joe Satilli, the best, the brightest, the best informed news gatherer and news analyst in all of America, and the best friend I have in Las Vegas, the best friend that Jim Garrison and John Kennedy could have, and with what he's put into this documentary that we have just done. Joe, welcome to the show. Say hello to Gino, your co-associate producer.
Gino, God, what a hilarious! I can't wait to hear the Johnny Roselli story. You gotta go. You gotta go into that, Gino.
Okay.
You be nice, or I bomb your house.
Yeah, there's a book out called "I Paint Houses" about some guy who was a hitman for the hoods, and evidently that was the expression they used if they wanted to get rid of somebody. First, though, Gino, very quickly, tell us briefly about this guy who was the dealer, who was also the marksman that Mo would take out in the desert to test his skills.
In the old days, first of all, he was a guy that was, and this story is strictly a story. So there's nothing 100%, I can 100% prove, but I'll tell you, I believe, because the guy told me, and I've checked the story from a couple different ways, and what I'm going to tell you at the end of it makes you wonder. You know, in the old days, when you wanted a dealer to work for you, you didn't have dealing schools. In the 50s and early 60s, they were rare. You had to have a friend teach you how to deal a game. So if they needed a dealer, they had to go to another place, another casino, another part of the country, and find somebody, and that's exactly what they did. And this fellow was in Phoenix City, Alabama, and Mr. Dalitz actually called over there and talked to the casino manager and said, I'm looking for a wheel roller. That's what they called him. You got somebody? He said, I got a guy that might be just good for you. And he was a sharpshooter in the Marines. He was a sniper. Anyway, so he comes out. Anyway, and I know this guy. He's 84 years old. I've known him for a lot of years. I know his wife. I'm not going to tell you the name on the air or anything like that or reveal him. But he told me how he was a sniper after the Korean War, and they actually worked for a general called Chesty Puller, I believe his name was, and went around the world, and that was his job as a sniper.
Wow.
And, you know, when you hear something like that, he opened up to me with nothing to gain from me. I mean, nothing to benefit. And he's just a friend of mine I've known for years. He just happened to see me writing, and he started talking about it. And I asked him, and I started pulling questions. I said, are you serious? This was really interesting to me, because I knew some people in Phoenix City, and my father was in the paratroopers across the river there, Fort Benning, Georgia. So he says, yeah, and he said they wanted a dealer, so I went out. I had nothing to lose, and I was a young guy. And after a couple of weeks, they saw I could deal, and Mr. Dalitz called me aside, and he says, I hear you're doing a good job here, and I hear you're also you were a sniper and a pretty good shot. And he said, yep, I was. And he said, well, sometime we'll go out to the desert, we'll shoot a few bottles or cans. Now, in those days, you have to understand the desert was a block out the door. There was nothing else. You know, the 50s, there was nothing out there. Nothing. So one day they did go out, and he could shoot a quarter and could shoot a dime. And he said, well, who knows? You might need you sometime. And that's the way he took that remark. So this guy went on to become an executive at the Desert Inn after being a dealer and become a floor man. He became an administrator. And he did functions for the office, administrative office. And he was there after Mo Dalitz sold the place, and he stayed there until Hughes even had it, you know, after Hughes had it, until he retired. So he wasn't just a Johnny-come-lately guy. But one day he was doing a job for Mr. Dalitz, and Mr. Dalitz was in the country club, which is in the back of the hotel. Beautiful place it was, a three-story building, and overlooked the golf course. And you could have a private meeting out there and pretty much be isolated. So my friend goes to the country club and starts to go up the stairs, and there's a couple of guys there dressed nice. He says, you know, Mr. Dalitz is having a meeting. Let me tell him you're here. And he said, okay. So he went up to get him, and they sent for him. He said, let him come up. And so my friend walked up. He was met at the front door to a little meeting room, and he was brought in, and Dalitz says, here's a gentleman I was telling you about. And Alan, well, this guy was a young guy then. And so he looks in the room, and I asked him this question three times on three different occasions, and he never flinched about anything I'm telling you. He said he saw Vice President Johnson in that room.
Oh, my goodness.
And a couple of other guys. I'm not going to speculate on the phone here, but there were a couple of other guys there. But he was there. That's all I'm going to tell you on this part of the story. And,
well,
I didn't believe it. So I went to the presidential library of Lyndon Johnson, and I found a date that he went to Las Vegas, and it even told what room he stayed in at the Desert Inn Hotel. So and that
wow.
was before the assassination. So, you know, I asked Alan, I said, did you ever have any issues you ever did for this gentleman? He said, you know, he had a few problems over the years when they try to threaten his family and things like that. So I kind of left it alone. But it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Wow, and, that is so interesting. Now, quickly, tell us about the day Joe asked you to tell you about the tell us about the date Johnny Roselli died.
Well, you know, I had a friend of mine. His name was Rothman, and his name was Al Rothman. His father's name was Chinky Rothman. He was a mob guy out of Philadelphia. He used to handle some of the dirty business for these guys. He used to hang around the Stardust. The Stardust alumni was like Sing Sing West, okay? That's how everybody that worked there, if you didn't have a record, you couldn't get a job in the old days, basically. And if you were a regular college guy, you had no chance. But if you were a guy that was on the streets, they'd put you to work. That's the way it was. You know, they trusted their own people. Anyway, Rothman was a little crazy. And Al Rothman, he met this girl that worked in a local drive-in called the Blue Onion Drive-In down on Fremont Street. Met this beautiful red-headed girl, and he liked her, and he got married to her. Then he brought her out to the Desert Inn where he worked and got her a job as a cocktail waitress. Johnny Roselli met this girl and went off with her, okay? And there's a couple of guys that told me that they think that Al Rothman is the one that offed Roselli over this girl. And it's a possibility. I'm not saying it's 100% probable, but it's a possibility. And
wow.
That story is not known by anybody. Not known by anybody.
My goodness. Joe, tell us what you think is the most interesting story that you've run across. Is it the fact that Jill Stein has raised enough money to get a recount in Wisconsin?
No.
What is then?
It's that... it's, you know, it's kind of funny that Gino is regaling all of your listeners with stories about the mob and all the interlocking connections that led to the building of Las Vegas and how Las Vegas was founded. Because, of course, Donald Trump, right, no small part, made his name off of Atlantic City.
Exactly.
And off of casinos and putting his name up in lights. Now, Trump has used the tax code to his benefit. As a matter of fact, much of the money he's made is off of playing the tax code in as a financial instrument. And what I'm finding really, really interesting is that we may be entering into a period of unparalleled conflicts of interest and, dare I say, corruption. Although, unfortunately, you know, the fake news stories, because they are well deserved that the media is painted as hypocrites for pointing out fake news, particularly given just the last 16 years and the lead up to the Iraq war. But putting all of the fake news blah, blah aside, the New York Times is doing some incredibly detailed reporting on the Trump octopus and all of the different countries where his interests reach and all of the places like a hotel building, a permit for a building in Argentina that's held up, and then he has a phone call with President Macri of Argentina, and Ivanka Trump is on the call, and guess what? The permit goes through, and all of a sudden the building starts. There
isn't,
are these guys.
Isn't he also trying to get windmills or something removed from the land around
in
his
Scotland?
Country?
Yeah, that's a that you know. Real Sports has been following the story for years about this golf course he built in Scotland. That. Environmentalists opposed, and one holdout refused to sell his property to Donald Trump and has painted the side of his barn with a quite colorful statement about Donald Trump. So when you're playing the back nine, you'll see this, this large sign that tells Donald Trump to get stuffed. And so the people of Scotland decided to put these windmills. He's trying to get rid of the windmills. He's got interests in India. He has interests in the Philippines. He has interest in Turkey. And by the way, his national security advisor, proposed national security advisor, General Flynn, who is really a strange Lovian type of character who believes that we are in a existential civilizational struggle against Islam to preserve American culture and society, doesn't really mind what's going on with President Erdogan there, and you know, he has been essentially a lobbyist through one degree of separation. Legal
well,
degree.
Joe, you have to explain something to me about capitalism and Donald Trump's success. How can you say you are a raging success in this country if you owe $1 billion?
Well, and by the way, he owes money. Half of this outstanding debt is to Deutsche Bank, which currently has a $14 billion judgment against them, a settlement judgment against them from the Justice Department that Deutsche Bank believes it might get out of, because he owes half of that money to them. He also owns a good portion of his debt to the State Bank of China.
Well, aren't
he is in hock to the Chinese government, basically, which, by the way, there's a thing called the emoluments clause in the Constitution, which would seem to be in violation of the Constitution on the moment that he is inaugurated. So, you know, how is it? Because, John, debt is an asset in America.
Okay,
that's how it's become, you know.
Gino, question. Has America changed that drastically to you? Has Las Vegas changed that drastically to you? Do you recognize the country you live in now?
Well, do you think things are any different than it was, say, 50 years ago, except we didn't have the internet to find out about so much of this stuff? I mean, there was less...
You know, quite honestly, I guess if you look back, people have been the same since Cain and Abel, and you're right. It was hidden from us then.
You know, I just want to say this. The biggest thing we have is the biggest problem I think we have is greed and corruption. That's it. If we taught more of that in school, maybe we'd be okay.
There's no question about that, but the only way you can curtail greed is by having laws that curtail greed. But it seems those laws have long since passed. I mean, as Joe pointed out with the passage of the Communications Act, Americans don't have any voice anymore. I mean, their voice is non-existent. All they have left.
I agree with that.
There's another thing at play here. And that's the financialization of the economy. We do not have primarily a productive economy in which people invest in factories to build widgets, to sell widgets, and employ people at a reasonable wage so that when they're done making widgets in your factory, they can go home and buy widgets made in other factories. What has happened over the course of the last 30 years progressively, and it, you know, really started to take flight during Reagan, and then it kind of fell, and then it took flight again during Clinton, and then it's taken flight again under Bush. And after the 2008 crisis was really sort of the culmination point of a long period of financialization in which the moving around of money and the playing with balance sheets is where the people who were in the investor class spent their time and effort. That's where they put their If you're a Forex trader, if you're a foreign exchange trader, you can make a lot of money with high-speed trading and the right algorithms off of 10-cent fluctuations in the dollar throughout the day. And you can make a lot of money doing that as opposed to building a factory in Peoria. And so the playing around with money, ironically, the kind of casino type of capitalism that has arisen as the regulations you've talked about have been pulled away, it has freed people up to basically, we have debt packaged into large securities and sold as a product. I mean, we are actually literally turning debt into a product that is sold, not widgets, but debt.
Derivatives,
exactly. Credit default swaps and insurance. We're going to sell you. We're going to trade. We're going to package in a group of insurance bets against a bunch of other debts and call it a product and sell it. I mean, that's how funky it has gotten. And so people wonder where the jobs are going. You know, Trump says, I'm going to bring back jobs from China. At the same time, China's automating all those jobs. And we are in this fundamental shift in the way the human economy, the global economy is going to work and the way humans will work. And we're entering into a period of potential job scarcity. And meanwhile, you know, the people at the top are playing in a giant casino called the global market.
Joe, did you know that the feds have their own lobbyists?
Of course.
The Federal Reserve has a lobbyist. Can you imagine that? Not one.
Well, the Federal Reserve is a lobby. And if you look at the revolving door between the SEC and the Treasury Department, there is a seamless flow of individuals back and forth between Wall Street and the Federal Reserve and the regulatory agencies that write the rules. When Dodd-Frank was passed, people said, hooray, hooray, hooray. And then I wrote a piece about the sausage making, the rulemaking, because once you pass a law, that's a general set of parameters of what the law is going to be. Then you have to go to the agencies and actually write the specific rules of how the law is going to be implemented. And guess who was at the table when all those laws were written? The people who were supposed to be regulated by the law.
Well, that,
the lawyers.
In all instances. I mean, the health industry writes the health laws. The industry writes the insurance laws.
That's right.
So, now, with the business of Wisconsin, what would happen, do you think, if it's reversed and they find that Hillary wins, so she gets those electoral college members? They don't have to vote for Hillary, do they?
Everything is pledged. I don't know about some states you have to, and there's some states where you're pledged, but you still have discretion. I know that there's one elector in Texas who is bailing out on principle. The recount effort now, the last I saw was that this Wisconsin said they were not going to go through with it, and now Jill Stein is going to have to sue to get them to do that. That's the last thing I saw before we came on the air. I mean, ultimately, I think that this has a lot more to do with Jill Stein raising money for the Green Party, because apparently she can use some of that money to do Green Party building efforts inside Wisconsin. But, you know, there is this weird thing that some analysts found that there was this differential between exit polls and the vote totals that seemed to match in a number of places, which seems to be a statistical anomaly. But I don't think that this is going anywhere, because President Obama is the one who convinced Hillary Clinton, apparently, to concede on election night. And Trump has been calling President Obama over the last couple of weeks on a regular basis, apparently, to try and get advice, because I don't think he knows what he's doing.
Well, listen, I know what I'm doing. I have two of the greatest people in this country on this show right now, Joe Satilli, Gino Menard. Gino, tell us how folks can find out more about you, where they can listen to that wonderful FM station that you have. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the station is owned by an organization called Reading, Writing, and Arithmetic, which is an organization that we've had in the community here to help the schools and the students in the schools and the teachers. And we honestly do that. It's been a fabulous feeling for me to be able to do that. You can listen to it several ways. The easiest way, of course, is if you get it in your car or turn on your radio and tune to 107.1. And there's also, we have a local number now, and I have to look it up to make sure I give it to you right.
How about the internet? Can they hear it on the internet?
On the internet at KIYQ.org. KIYQ.org. Right. Hold on, I'm going to give you the other number while I'm looking here. But you can also dial a local number here in Nevada, which makes our station actually go everywhere. In other words, it gives it the same as having a 50,000-watt station. And all you have to do is call 702-489-0110. That's 702. That's 702-489-0110. From any telephone. Doesn't have to be a cell phone. Any phone. A desk phone.
And I'll tell folks out there, they have great hosts. They have the greatest music, played anywhere.
Gambling stuff. We talk gambling tips. We talk about incidences. We have Teresa Banning, who's a wonderful gaming writer. Wild West and gamblers.
Okay,
it's fun stuff.
Where can they catch you?
Just, we're out of time, so go to newsvandal.com, folks.
Okay, thank you both very, very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Mike Kim, my producer, Mr. Newsom, our engineer. Good luck. Good night. Talk to you in a couple of weeks.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.